This hour brought to you by GCNLife.com. Live younger, look younger, feel younger at GCNLife.com. The gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
So then, when we created this conversation for this week's episode of PowerCast, we used Skype as we always do. And Skype tends to be buggy, as it always is. And it calls these conversations shiny and new because, well, I don't know if our guest, Kevin Randall, has a shiny face or J. Randall Murphy, my face is dark red. That's not true. It's just that Skype is buggy. We started the conversation and suddenly it's crapped out on us, which is not a nasty word. It's just a word that we are using because of the fact that things didn't work out. Anyway, Kevin D. Randall's with us. And before we get to talking about his new book, the Best of Project Blue Book, let's talk about the best of something else a little bit. Now, you haven't talked to Nick Redfern yet, Kevin, as you've told us, but do you have any preliminary thoughts about the possibility that the Rendlesham Forest UFO episode may have been a government experiment and not some kind of weird phenomenon from somewhere else?
I have communicated with Nick Redfern. I'm going to have him on my program in about a week and have an opportunity to explore this in greater depth. But I have talked to John Burroughs, and when I had him on the program, he was talking about his belief or his theory that the Rendlesham Forest experiences transcended more than just the three nights in December of 1980, that it was much more involved in that. And it was his idea that there was some kind of a British research organization or facility nearby, and they may have been the cause behind the displays that were witnessed by the American airmen. So postulating from that, I wonder if that is where Nick is going with his look at Rendlesham Forest, since his book is, I guess, aligned closely with John Burroughs. But having talked to Jim Pettiston and Charles Hull, both of whom have been again on my program, they seem to be of the opinion that it's some sort of extraterrestrial craft or some sort of extraterrestrial display. So you've got two diverging opinions now based on the people who were actually there and the evidence that, or their perspectives of what they saw that night. So that's my only guess, is that Nick is kind of reporting on what John Burroughs believes to be the truth of the Rendlesham Forest events in today's environment.
Now, it's also true that Nick has found or tried to find terrestrial explanations for other key cases. He mentions, of course, Cash Landra, which happened around the same rough time frame in America, and, of course, even Roswell. But what about Cash Landrum? Do you think that might have been a government experiment of some kind?
The problem I have with Cash Landrum is the report of all these Chinook helicopters involved in it. And it transpired over the Christmas holidays, or basically in that time frame. And an awful lot of the military goes on leave or goes home. It's the people on active duty or people on duty is reduced significantly during that holiday period. So I'm wondering where they got all the pilots and crewmen for all the helicopters that were supposedly involved in this display. That's kind of worrisome for me. I haven't looked at it in a great deal. I know Phil Klass talked about wanting to see the medical records of Cash Landrum because they, of course, manifested some medical problems after the encounter, and he wondered if that might be ongoing or it had been exacerbated by the close approach of this object that they witnessed. So there are things about it that are interesting, but I haven't explored those in great depth.
Now, in the book, and you'll get to it when you read it, he also talks about the Pascagoula, Mississippi abduction as some kind of experiment and suggests that even Betty and Barney Hill might have been. Are we moving it one step too far there?
I talked to a guy named Terry Lovelace about his abduction experience. And it seemed to me that one of the possible explanations for it, since it was a one-time abduction, might have been some kind of psychological experiment conducted by the AFOSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigation, or some kind of an experiment conducted under their watch. So we do have those kinds of stories out there. I just don't think Barney and Betty Hill is any kind of an experiment conducted by the United States government or other organizations. Pascagoula, I've talked to Calvin Parker, and I interviewed him on my radio program about a year ago, and he seemed to be very down to earth. So he's relating to us, I believe, what he believes to be the absolute truth. Whether or not it was some kind of government experiment, I don't know. And I just don't see how, given what he's talked about, what Hickson talked about, and some of the additional witnesses they have located, and I say they, Philip Mantle and Calvin Parker, have located, I don't see how this could be some kind of a government experiment. But we also know that the government has done that. We can go back to the 1960s and their LSD experiments, spreading LSD in subways to see how people reacted to it and things like that. So we know that the government does those sorts of things on an unsuspecting public. But these seems to be much more robust, much more comprehensive, much more hard to pull off in that kind of a guise. And it begins to strain credulity that they are able to do something like that without the evidence of that coming out.
Yes, that's something that is really curious. In a lot of cases, I mean, here we are still in 2020 looking for real evidence. I mean, you were talking about all of the helicopters that may have been involved in the Cash Landrum case. That's a really good point. And where are those pilots today? Where are all those witnesses today? You would think that after all of this time, at least two or three of them might have come forward. And say,
well, it's not just the air crews with Cash Landrum. It's also the support people, the logistical support, because you don't fly those helicopters without an awful lot of fuel. You've got maintenance personnel. You've got other air crew members. You've got administrative personnel. You've got to have all sorts of records. There's all kinds of things that are necessary to move that many aircraft into that arena at that time. So the fact that we don't have somebody coming out and said, yes, I was involved in this experiment is quite worrisome to suggest it is an experiment, because with like Roswell, and I bring this up because we talked to many, many people in Roswell, and there's an awful lot of people involved in Roswell, and we were able to crack that egg because people talked to us. And yet we don't have that sort of thing with Cash Landrum. We have people coming forward from Roswell saying, yes, I was there. And we would vet the people and say, yeah, you were there. What did you see? What did you hear? And we don't have any of that with Cash Landrum. And there would have to be, I think they were talking maybe as many as 40 helicopters involved. And so you've got to figure at least 60 pilots. At least 60 pilots, and then you've got crew chiefs and flight engineers. You've got the logistical support people, the truck drivers that would be bringing the fuel in for the helicopters. You've got other maintenance that needs to be done. You've got to have quarters for all those people. Where are they going to stay? How are you going to feed them? You've got all of that logistical support, and somebody involved in that would have been a short timer, might have been somebody who had just doing one tour in the military, would have come forward and said, yes, I was involved in this and this is what I saw. And we just don't have any of that.
And you're not just talking through your hat. I mean, let's remind listeners here that you did pilot UH-1 helicopters in the United States Army.
And by the way, our interview with Kevin D. Randall will not end with this episode. He's going to come back for this weekend's After the Paracast podcast. After the Paracast, of course, is an exclusive feature of the Paracast Plus. For more information on what you get when you subscribe, go to theparacast.plus. We are going to continue this discussion and focus dead on with the best of Project Blue Book and lots more. Kevin D. Randall joins us, and it's always a blast when he's on the show. With Gene and Randall, the other Randall. You're in
the Paracast.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on this special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there's The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, R-O-C-K-O-I-D-S.com.
This is a pandemic survival alert and the most time-sensitive messages you will hear this year. You still have time to plant a one-acre crisis garden and secure a supply of your own nutrient-dense food. But time is running out, and it's one deadline you don't want to miss. Who should plant a crisis garden? Individuals, families, churches, communities, anyone or any group that sees hard times ahead. Let's face it, even the mainline media is talking about food supply disruptions and the growing number of grocery store workers who are becoming sick. But there's more. Meat packing plants are closing, mile-long lines at food pantries, and more farmers now in financial trouble. The truth is, growing nutrient-dense vegetables this summer may be the single most important thing you do. Go to SurvivalSeedBank.com and watch the new video to understand what we're really up against. Get free bonus seeds, special quarantine reports, too. Don't wait. Every minute counts. Go to SurvivalSeedBank.com. That's SurvivalSeedBank.com.
With more people listening to radio than visit Google, Facebook, or YouTube, from the very young to the very old, everyone listens to radio. Pillow companies, alarm, identity theft, nutrition, insurance, banking, automotive, the list goes on and on. Billion-dollar businesses, why? The answer is radio, the media everyone tunes into. Find out how effective and affordable radio can be for your business. Contact 877-996-4327 or advertise at gcnlive.com.
Hand sanitizer is not an option. It's now a must-have. But beware, not all hand sanitizers are created equal. That is why you want to use 2020 Safe Hand Sanitizer. You can trust the hand sanitizer on 2020safe.net to be made with the highest quality ingredients. American-made with American ingredients. Employing Americans. Log on now at 2020safe.net and order your liter bottle and receive a bonus. That's right. You'll receive a 30-count bottle of Immune Booster, a $14.95 value, free. By using code GCN at checkout, 2020safe.net offers many natural products to help support health and help you live a more fulfilled life. From germ-zapping hand sanitizer to immune-building nutraceuticals, 2020safe.net has what you need in stock today. Just click 2020safe.net. Remember to enter GCN at checkout, and the bonus is yours free. Go now to 2020safe.net.
Complement your health with hemp-derived cannabinoid oil. We've always believed that the closer to Earth, the better it is for our bodies. Our hemp-derived cannabinoid oil is phytocannabinoid-rich, full-spectrum, and organically grown. Finally, hemp made easy, clean, and effective. GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203. That's right, we cut through the red tape. It's now available at GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
So we've got Randall and Randall, J. Randall Murphy, Kevin D. Randall. I'm Gene Steinberg. I'm not changing. I don't have a middle name, by the way. All these people have middle names. I don't have a middle name. It's my brother's fault. Anyway, we were discussing here the fact that when we talk about helicopter availability and what was going on during Cash Landrum, that our guest, Kevin D. Randall, was a helicopter pilot. and we're continuing on that.
Kevin, you can tell our audience a little bit about your experience with helicopters and serving in the United States Army.
There's not really much to tell. I think everybody's pretty familiar with it. I was a helicopter pilot aircraft commander in Vietnam. I have probably 1,200 combat hours in helicopters in Vietnam, plus additional flight time, and was involved in these sorts of things. We did a number of exercises. When I transitioned into the Air Force, we did a number of exercises where we had to move great numbers of people and great amounts of equipment from one location to another, and then complete some sort of mission. So I understand the logistics of that sort of an activity. And if you start bringing in a large number of people, there's going to be a paper trail. There's going to be a way of getting to that. People are going to talk about it. No matter how careful you are and how carefully you select the people, there's always going to be somebody that's going to talk about it. And once the information comes out, and Pappy Henderson is a perfect example of this. Pappy Henderson was involved in the Roswell case and had flown the debris or the bodies from Roswell into Wright Field, Wright Patterson Air Force Base, and he was in the grocery store with his wife and saw, you know, I think it was the National Tattler, one of those tabloid newspapers, the story of the Roswell case, and he bought the newspaper and gave it to her and said, "Read this," and she did, and he said, "I've wanted to tell you about this for years, and I guess now that it's in the newspaper, I can tell you about it," and so he came forward and talked about it. The point is, he was wrong. Even though it was in the newspaper, he had access to classified information. He was not free to talk about it just because somebody had reported it in the newspaper. And so when you move into the Cash Landrum thing, it's gotten an awful lot of publicity. There's been documentaries about it. There's an awful lot of information out there. There's magazine articles and newspaper articles about it. So somebody reading about that who was involved in it would say, well, now I can come forward and talk about what I'd seen or what I'd done. And none of that has happened with the Cash Landrum. So if you've got a report of a large number of helicopters operating in this time frame, and the information being out there, somebody should have broken security and come forward. And we just don't have that. And that should be worrisome, which suggests only that the idea that there were a lot of helicopters involved in chasing this diamond-shaped object or whatever it was is true. It may be a misperception by the witnesses. It may be other factors involved. But the fact we don't have anybody coming forward from the military end of it is quite worrisome, which then again suggests it wasn't some kind of an experiment. It was something else.
And of course, when we go back that far as Project Blue Book, for example, we do have people who have come forward. Edward Ruppelt, the first head of that project, wrote a whole book about it. Basically, we're going through ufology 101 here when we're talking about Project Blue Book. And a lot of our listeners are going to know a lot of the basics about it, but I still think it's really important to bring it up from time to time and go through it, because back in those days, it wasn't as simple as, oh, it could be an illusion or holograms or something like that. We just didn't have the technology to reproduce what some of these things were doing back then. So for me, it seems like this is the golden era is really the best era to look at sightings. Personally, you know, why do you think people today should still care about something like Project Blue Book, which took place back in the 50s and 60s.
Blue Book was the official investigation of UFOs. This was the government's interest in finding out what UFOs were. When we look at the history, which began in 1948, officially began in 1948, there's indications that an unofficial project existed as early as December of 1946. Project Blue Book, actually Project Sign, began in January of 1948 after the Kenneth Arnold sightings in June of 1947. But if we look at that history, we see there are periods where they had done good investigations, attempting to gather the proper information and learn what was going on. And then there were periods where they were paying lip service to it, and they really didn't care. As long as they could write an explanation down and file it away, they were happy. Ruppelt came in 1951, I believe it was, when it was still Project Grudge, and then it transformed into Project Blue Book under his watch. And when he came in, it was because they hadn't been doing good investigations. They hadn't been doing much of anything, and he revitalized the program. But a year and a half later, all of the steam was taken out of the program after the Robertson panel, which was a CIA-sponsored review of the Project Blue Book materials, decided there was nothing to it and they needed to debunk it. And so we've got this history of Blue Book gathering information, filing it away, assuming that nobody would ever see it. And now it's out in the public arena that we can all look through the Project Blue Book files. And when we go through the Blue Book files, which is what I'd done in the book, I looked at some of the best cases where there were multiple witnesses, where there was interaction with the environment, where there was some kind of other evidence involved, to see what the Air Force might have had hidden away in the files, and discovered some very amazing things about the UFO cases that some of them are well known and some of them aren't all that well known, and how those explanations came to be and where it stands today. So we're learning from the Air Force investigation that if we look at it dispassionately and ignore either the ridicule factor or the desire to believe and try to examine exactly what was said and who said what and how it was written down, we get a whole different picture of Project Blue Book. There's some very good information in there. There's some very good cases in it. But you can see where at times the Air Force diverted attention. And what I mean here is, in November of 1957, there was a series of sightings in Levelland, Texas. It took place over several hours. There were people all over the place, Levelland, seeing it. The craft getting close to the ground, stalling car engines, filling radios with static, dimming headlights, and that sort of thing. The Air Force said there were only three witnesses to the object. Don Kehoe, who was the director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was a civilian organization, NGO, non-governmental organization, said no, there were nine witnesses to the object. Going through the Blue Book files, I found witnesses at 13 separate locations. So they got into a big fight over the number of witnesses and overlooked what was going on. You know, well, there were these many witnesses. No, there weren't. There were only these many witnesses. Well, what did they see? What was going on? How do you explain the electromagnetic effects? How do you explain them stalling the car engines? You get the idea that the sheriff of Levelland, who went out, and you can see the reports in the Blue Book files and other locations, said that he only got within about 900 yards of the thing, and it was only a red streak of light. And yet family members reported to Don Burleson, who coincidentally lives in Roswell, which is about 3 hours from Levelland, interviewed the family of the sheriff in 2000, I think it was, and they said no, he'd gotten much closer and he'd seen a circular craft, some kind of disc-shaped object. And you're thinking, well, they're talking about this some 50 years later. It really doesn't mean much in today's environment. I found a newspaper article where the reporters had actually interviewed the sheriff like 2 days after the sightings, and he said that he'd gotten much closer to it. It was circular. It was a red circular object that he'd seen. So we get some corroboration for that, and now we've got the sheriff involved.
More to come. Levelland, Texas. Gene Steinberg, J. Randall Murphy, Kevin D. Randall. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Frustrated trying to get business capital? Want to take the slow process and rejection out of the equation? GCNloans.com removes the slow, irritating approval process. Instead, get quick, simple funding. Powered by David Allen Capital, 80% of our pre-qualified clients are approved in days. Pre-qualify at GCNloans.com and get your money this week. It's that easy. GCNloans.com. That's GCNloans.com.
Houseflies defecate every 4 to 5 minutes, spreading diseases and germs. Protect your food and your health with Bug Assault, a miniaturized shotgun which utilizes ordinary table salt as ammunition. Non-toxic, no batteries required, only $39.95. Use discount code GCN and get an extra 10% off your purchase at bugassault.com. Fire your fly swatter. Get your Bug Assault today.
USA Radio News with Wendy King.
On this Memorial Weekend, people are heading to the parks and beaches despite the coronavirus pandemic. Governor Andrew Cuomo said beachgoers were following the rules. But in coastal South Georgia, Tybee Island Mayor Shirley Sessions said some beachgoers wore masks, but not enough of them.
I think it's one of those things that is becoming a complacent situation, and I think that people are just thinking that the sun is going to, you know, kill any germs that may be out there, and they've just gotten a little bit kind of forgetting that it's still very real.
Minnesota's governor is easing some restrictions in his state.
Starting on May 27th, places of worship may open at a 25% occupancy if they adhere to social distancing and other public health guidelines to keep congregants safe.
This is USA Radio News. A fire has engulfed a warehouse on San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf. It sent smoke over the waterfront, threatening to spread to a historic World War II-era ship before firefighters brought the flames under control. Lieutenant John Baxter with the fire department says this was a tough one to fight.
Throughout the progress of this fire, we did see almost every portion of this building collapse in one area or another.
The Department of Justice has sent a letter to the mayor of Los Angeles warning that an extension of the coronavirus stay-at-home order may be unlawful. Eric Garcetti says the question is, do you want to save lives or not?
We'll be guided by science and industry working together to figure out the steps forward. And last thing I'll say is there's no, you know, city in the world that right now doesn't have some sort of orders and restrictions, because we know this virus kills. Full stop.
You're listening to USA Radio News.
In today's world, violent crime can victimize anyone, anytime. When violent crime confronts you, will you be able to protect yourself and your loved ones? For personal protection training, there's none better than FrontSight, the world's premier firearms training facility near Las Vegas, Nevada. Learn firearm skills from FrontSight's world-class instructors, led by FrontSight's founder and director, Dr. Ignatius Piazza. Whether you're in law enforcement, the military, or a private citizen, after your first firearm training course at FrontSight, you'll leave with skills that surpass 99% of the gun-owning population, guaranteed. And now, you and your family can train at FrontSight free of charge. Yes, free. Go now to frontsight.com/radio to secure a $2,000 four-day defensive handgun course. Absolutely free with no catch. Enter FrontSight.com/radio. Act now before these free courses are all taken. Secure your free four-day course at frontsight.com/radio. FrontSight, America's gun training destination.
This is the Merciless. You are listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio, exactly according to my plan.
Okay, so you're the kind of guy who likes to chase the original sources, I guess, as you did here, Kevin Randall to Levelland, Texas, and the original newspaper story, that is?
Many, many stories about it. You can probably go to your local library and pull up the microfilm from early November of 1957 and find stories about the Levelland sightings. But the problem is, and you go through the Project Blue Book files, which are available online, and you get a different perspective of what exactly was going on, that the Air Force actually knew more than they let on. But you also see where it was suggested that maybe the sheriff shouldn't be talking to the news media about it, and you can see how the whole thing was manipulated to make it much less exciting than it really was. You've got an object approaching cars and causing the car engines to stall. And so now you've got interaction with the environment. The sheriff actually took his daughter out to a ranch near Levelland day or two later, where there was a burned area found in one of the rancher's fields, which now presents us with some physical evidence. Unfortunately, in 1957, everybody's so busy arguing about the number of witnesses, nobody gets out there and looks at it. We also see that according to the newspapers, there was one Air Force investigator, I think it was from the 4602nd Air Intelligence Service Squadron, from Reese Air Force Base, which is Lubbock, which is 15 minutes away from Levelland, who came out and spent most of the day interviewing some of the witnesses. But there are hints in the Project Blue Book files of a much higher ranking officer coming out and conducting a little bit more in-depth investigation. So there are hints of things in the Blue Book files which suggest to us that the case was much more exciting than the Air Force led on and the news media led on at the time. And you also have to remember back in 1957, now we're in the period where ridicule is the factor. The news media doesn't take reports of flying saucers real anymore. They think they're too sophisticated to believe in alien spacecraft. And so they're on board with the Air Force explanations. They believe the Air Force is telling them the truth about what's going on, and the Air Force is shading the truth quite a bit. And so by looking at these sort of cases in the best of Project Blue Book, I was able to bring in our knowledge today the interviews with the sheriff's wife and daughter from 2000 and apply it to the information that was developed and put in the Project Blue Book files back in 1957. So we get a whole different take on exactly what happened in that case.
But can we really be sure of what happened? I mean, with this, it kind of reminds me of the Fox Lake case in 1996 in the Yukon up here in Canada. Because the Levelin case, that happened like about an hour after Sputnik 2 was launched. And how do we know it wasn't some re-entering space debris? Now, in the Yukon case, we've also got people who said that they watched it pass overhead, saw windows, somebody's car stalled, another one, their tape deck dimmed and slowed down. And so you have these conflicting reports from eyewitnesses who say that this object was much closer, and yet you've got the skeptics that say, well, no, it was probably just this re-entering space debris.
There was no re-entering space debris in November of 1957. Yes, there was a Sputnik launch, but there was also one 30 days earlier in October of 1950. Sputnik 1 went up. So there's clearly no reason for the people in Levelland to start seeing UFOs, because the second launch hadn't been reported widely at the time and they were unaware of it. You have the people at different locations describing the same thing. You have the law enforcement talking about it, and it's approaching close to the ground and then taking off. It's not like something seen reentering. In the reentry, Zod 4, I think in 1968, broke up, and there were people who reported a cigar-shaped craft with square windows on it, similar to the Childs Whitted sighting from 1948, which probably was meteoric in nature. But here with Levelland, the thing is approaching the ground. It's landed in certain areas, and you've got the people over a long period of time seeing. It's not like this all happened at one time. The object was seen in a number of locations around Levelland, and the sightings took place over, 2.5 and 3 hours, and then a couple of hours later, you have another set of sightings at White Sands Missile Range, which is several hundred miles away. And the people at White Sands, and I should point out, military policemen at White Sands, had no way of knowing what was being reported in Levelland, Texas. And I talked to one of the MPs who was there at the time, and he told me what he had seen and how it was misrepresented in the Air Force reports and how it was misrepresented in the newspapers. So it's really not two of the same things. The reentry theory doesn't work because it lasted way too long. There was nothing to be reentering. If it had been meteoric in origin, it would have lasted, the whole sighting would have lasted less than a minute. You might see the ionized trail from it for several minutes persisting, but that's it. And you've got the people who are talking about it being very close to the ground. In fact, the Air Force never even talked about it being any kind of reentry or something like that, simply because it's simply untrue. And according to the news reports or the weather reports, the sky was overcast. So they wouldn't have been seeing that kind of thing anywhere unless it was below the cloud deck. And so you can kind of rule out the idea of returning space debris in 1957, because there wasn't a whole lot of space debris to return. And if it was meteoric, it would have lasted much longer. And I don't know of any cases where a meteor stalled a car engine. So you've got to take a look at all of that sort of thing, and you've got reports, and they're not just, they're all around the Levelland area, so it's not like it's in a very confined area. It's over several square miles that these things take place, and the witnesses got good looks at it. It wasn't that they saw the thing in the distance or they saw the thing in the sky. It came down close to them. It was on the ground for 4 or 5 minutes, according to some of the witnesses who saw it on the ground in different locations. So they all got a very good look at it. So it's not quite the same thing as some of those other cases.
It also shows, when you have things like this, a disparity of information, that they didn't have what we have today. Anything that happens that's important, you would think we would have immediate access to the information. It would go worldwide. And it would be more difficult to have widely disparate versions. On the other hand, sometimes it doesn't seem that way. It seems that you could look at the same event and A happened, and the other version is, no, it was Z. So I don't know whether today's media situation would have made it easier or harder to get a handle on this.
The Air Force would have had a much more difficult time of suppressing the information. They were able to come up with a suggestion. I think one of the reports said, well, it was ball lightning. 1957, science wasn't even sure ball lightning existed. So we're using a unusual, unproven phenomenon to explain another unexplainable phenomenon. We now understand what ball lightning is, and rarely is it larger than two feet in diameter. It persists for just a matter of seconds, and their displays are extremely rare. So you wouldn't have it been seen all over Levelland in that area for several hours, a couple of hours, and it wouldn't have been as large as it was described by many of the witnesses who saw it, or were close to it. Wouldn't have had the effects on the car engines and the headlights and the radio. If I'd have filled the radio with static, we know lightning can kind of, an electrical discharge will cause the radios to fill with static, but it certainly doesn't dim headlights and stall car engines.
Exactly. I mean, this is kind of the point I was hoping to get to. With all of that, is that there will be a case that seems really great at first with all of this information, and someone will come out and say, well, what about this? This seemed to happen at that time. And then people like yourself or ufologists that dig into it more will go, well, no. Like even the Fox Lake sighting that I was just talking about had very similar things. They tried to write it off as this reentering space capsule.
I have to say this, Randall, there are sure quite a few space capsules breaking up in the atmosphere around a time when there were, could only have been one or two. More to come with Kevin Randall. Gene and Randall, you're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
We also have swag. You know, we have all these exclusive Paracast things that you can buy. We've got like, I guess, 60 or so different items. And entails t-shirts, sleeves for notebook computers, iPad cases, mouse pads, the Paracast jumbo tote bag, all sorts of t-shirts and jackets and stuff like that for men and women. We have a Paracast aluminum water bottle. All this stuff, you go to store.theparacast.com, store.theparacast.com. What makes it special is that the items are the best quality, you know, great t-shirts, fabrics, and they have our official logo on them. That's what makes them special, in multiple sizes and colors. We even have stuff for children, stuff for women, stuff for men. We have all sorts of sizes, like small up to X large. A lot of good stuff. That's the swag from the Paracast. You go to store.theparacast.com, stop by, and take a shopping tour.
Do the letters IRS give you anxiety? I'm Dan Pilla. I've defended people from the IRS for more than 40 years. My book, How to Get Tax Amnesty, created the tax resolution industry and is responsible for helping hundreds of thousands of people. It can help you, too. If you're a non-filer or facing IRS enforcement right now, your case is unique. You need real help, not cookie-cutter advice. My clients get my personal attention. Buy my book at danpilla.com and get a free consultation directly with me. That's danpilla.com. Let's start solving your tax problem right now.
We've all seen and perhaps use the alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Have you noticed how it dries your skin, and as soon as the alcohol evaporates, it's no longer effective? GCNteam.com has alcohol-free antibacterial soap and foam, meeting or exceeding all requirements set forth by the United States Food and Drug Administration. Come to GCNteam.com. Keyword antibacterial, or call 877-878-4203.
Stop aging now. Restore those joints. Boost your strength. Because it's official. NutriMedical has released the most exciting, powerful anti-aging supplement on the market. Dr. Bill Deagle's Red Deer Velvet DR has been approved by the U.S. Patent Office. Imagine stem cell rejuvenation all in one capsule without huge expense. Dr. Bill MD discovered that as an unborn baby grows in the mother's womb, he or she does not deteriorate or physically age. Red Deer Velvet DR, like the uterus, provides 300 biomolecules and six hormones protected in one special DR capsule that delivers lipid packages directly into your circulation. This patented technology bypasses the stomach and is released into the small bowel unaltered by digestive enzymes and stomach acid. Remember, Red Deer Velvet DR. Improve endurance, simulate your immune system, increase learning ability, and even improve sexual libido with Red Deer Velvet DR. Click NutriMedical.com. That's NutriMedical.com. Or call toll-free 888-212-8871 and get on the road to a newer, rejuvenated, happier you.
If you have diabetes and you're on Medicare, Medicaid, or have private insurance, you may qualify for a new continuous glucose monitor. Managing your diabetes is crucial to your health. The new CGM can automatically and easily help you manage your diabetes more effectively. And by using a CGM, you can eliminate the one thing most people with diabetes dislike the most, finger sticks. Now you can automatically manage your diabetes and end the painful finger sticks. Solara Medical Supplies makes it simple for you to have a new CGM. We'll do all the insurance paperwork for you and deliver the newest in diabetic care technology right to your door. Take charge of your diabetes today with the help of a new continuous glucose monitor. Call now to learn more.
800-547-5331. 800-547-5331. 800-547-5331. That's 800-547-5331.
Hi, this is Nick Pope. You're listening to the Paracast.
It's amazing how many secret spacecraft there must have been then, Randall, that they have all these returning space capsules flooding the airwaves in 1957.
Or, I mean, even later. I mean, like, how does that explain where one person sees this thing, they stop and get out of their car, and they look and they see it hovering over the lake? You know, that's like seeing, in the case of Leveland, when it's like on the road. Or so... We have something similar with the Phoenix lights, too, where there's the flares that are going down behind the mountains. Yeah, okay, those are flares. But that doesn't explain the other people who saw it go, some kind of craft go straight overhead. So why are there always these extras added on to these cases, do you think?
I'm not sure about extras being added onto the case. The Phoenix lights... you've got a lot of people outside seeing a lot of strange things. And we do know the flare explanation resolved part of it. And we have all this other information about, I think it was a big triangular-shaped object. And in my mind, I see it as going from Tucson in southeastern Arizona up to the northwestern parts of Arizona. But I think the path may have been the other direction. But you have people looking at it, and they're seeing it at different times and from different locations, and so you have that sort of thing going on. With Leveland, you just had the people, a couple of the witnesses came forward after they heard the news reports the next day and said that they had seen the thing. But we don't have any evidence of the other explanations. We don't have... I say they threw out the ball lightning thing to kind of confuse the issue, and I think the Air Force job in 1957, as they saw it, was to explain UFO sightings. It wasn't to investigate them, it was to explain them. And you read the Air Force regulations, and they tell you that basically is it. If the case is easily solved, if you have a good explanation for it, you being the local Air Force UFO investigator, then you're authorized to tell the press about it. If you have no good explanation, then you're required to tell the press to check with the Air Force Office of Information at the Pentagon. The information separated that way. This is in the regulation, so you can see the dichotomy there. There's also all kinds of letters from Project Blue Book in the administrative files that you read. They say, well, possible explanations will be accepted. So, well, that could have been this. Okay, that's what it becomes. And you can see on the project cards sometimes where it would say possible aircraft or possible balloon, the possible has been crossed out. And so then it became a balloon, and the explanations continue on in that vein. In the Lubbock lights, and interesting, Lubbock is not all that far from Leveland. We've got the series of photographs taken by Carl Hart Jr., which shows us the V-shaped formation of the lights traveling over Lubbock. But you've got a lot of people out there looking at things, and anything they see in the sky they're not familiar with, they report it as a UFO. So then you can begin to see explanations for it. There is no good explanation for the photographs taken in Lubbock. I talked to Carl Hart Jr. He's the guy that took them. He was 19 at the time. And I always say that 99% of the UFO photographs were taken by teenage boys, and 99% of those are hoaxes. But I talked to Carl Hart Jr. in the mid-1990s, so it's what, 40 years after he had taken his photographs. And I asked him point blank, I said, what'd you photograph? He says, I still don't know. There is no reason for him not to tell us what he photographed. He'd somehow faked him or hoaxed him in 1951. There's no reason for him not to tell us in today's environment. So you've got these photographs that are inexplicable. Do they prove alien visitation? No, they're just photographs that we cannot explain in terrestrial terms. And that doesn't necessarily take us to the extraterrestrial. And I think that's, you know, when we look at the whole of the UFO phenomena, we also have a group of people, and especially after the Robertson panel in 1953, put out the idea we have to debunk UFOs. They used the term debunk UFOs. They suggested that teachers not allow students to do reports on UFOs, not allow students to read books on UFOs, to find sightings that seemed mysterious at one time, but now have good, solid explanations, and point these out to the public. And you can see how that kind of morphed into the mainstream of the time. You go back to 1947 with the sightings there, and you'd see even then they were kind of lowering the ridicule curtain. And one of the headlines, I think it was in a newspaper in Kansas, said, flying saucers seen in 38 states, but not Kansas. Because Kansas was a dry state, meaning, of course, that there weren't a lot of drunks out there hallucinating. So there's always been this ridicule factor, and there's always been the people that seem to be too sophisticated to believe in alien visitation. And there are always the people out there who, for some reason, want to dissuade you from your beliefs, no matter what your belief structure is. They may not like the president, so it's their mission to convince you the president is a bad guy. Or they may love the president, it's their mission to convince you that the president is a good guy. But, you know, you've got to take a look at all the information yourself and decide where you come down. And I think with the UFO, they were trying to direct that information. They were actively working to produce articles and other information that suggested that UFOs weren't real. There was a movie that came out in 1956 called Cleverly UFO, Unidentified Flying Objects. And they interviewed some of the witnesses that had come forward, like Delbert Newhouse, who had taken photographs of movie footage of UFOs over Trinidad, Utah in 1952. Nick Mariana, who had taken movie footage of UFOs over Great Falls, Montana in 1950. Pilots who'd seen UFOs and this sort of thing. And there's a lot of correspondence in the Air Force administrative files about how they are going to respond to this movie. It's not that they just going to say, well, good movie, we enjoyed it, have at it. It was, what are we going to do to dissuade people from believing? How are we going to respond to the questions that are going to come out there? Clearly they're directing their personnel on how to respond to questions about the film, and it's all in a derogatory sense, you know. And you can see that, as I say, by looking at other aspects, other cases from the Project Blue Book files where they append explanations that are patently preposterous. I don't really look at the Kelly Hopkinsville case in the Vesta Project Blue Book. This is a sighting where a family in Kentucky thought they were being harassed by alien creatures and were shooting at them. They'd seen UFOs. They finally got so scared they went to the sheriff's office. And the Air Force really never investigated it. There was some guy who kind of interjected himself and some major who heard about the story, and he went down and looked into it. But the Air Force explanation, and it's really not a case file, there's just information only, but their explanation is, well, it was a monkey that got loose from a traveling carnival, and these the people involved, Langsford's, I think it was, Sutton family, the Langsford family, were holy rollers, and they had been to a revival meeting that night, and they were all ginned up from the revival meeting, so they were having all these hallucinations. Preposterous, because A, they weren't holy rollers, and B, there was no carnival in there to let a monkey escape, and these guys are shooting at it with shotguns, and it's getting close enough, and it's like it's harassing them, and it comes back, and then it goes away, and it comes back, and they're shooting at it with shotguns. We've hit it, and we knocked it down, it jumped up and ran away. Yeah, what kind of monkey has that capability? And if there was one that does that, we should get a hold of that monkey to understand what kind of body armor it was wearing. But, I mean, they just offered preposterous explanations. And you see those preposterous explanations repeated in the skeptical community without any critical thought about it. And that's always kind of what bothered me. And it works both ways. I mean, we've got the true believers who are not going to reject a sighting no matter how carefully you've debunked that sighting and proven that it was something mundane. They're not going to let go of it. And on the skeptical side of the fence, the debunkers are not going to accept any evidence that suggests their explanation simply doesn't work. They're incapable of saying, I don't know. It's unidentified. They seem incapable of saying that.
What's really interesting,
that's all we have.
Kevin, what's really interesting about all of that is that even with that anti-UFO bias that they had back then, when they did the statistical breakdown of all the sightings that they kept, I mean, you can imagine how many that just went into the trash bin. There was still over 26% that they classified as unknown. And that means not just insufficient data. That means that there was enough data there that if it was something that was identifiable, they should have been able to identify it, but they couldn't. So even with all of that bias, there was still something weird going on that they didn't know how to explain.
I looked at one of the cases in the Best of Project Blue Book toward the end of the Project Blue Book's life. It took place in Austin, Texas. A guy had seen something and watched it for quite a while. And reported to the Air Force. An Air Force officer, a lieutenant, came out and talked to him. They filled out that stupid form the Air Force had, which is, looking at it from a scientific perspective, is really doesn't gather the kind of information you really want gathered.
Let's gather this information and get back to that. Best of Project Blue Book is the book. Kevin Randall, Gene Steinberg, J. Randall Murphy, you're in
the Paracast.
Listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Attack of the Rockoids has been well received by critics and readers alike. It's a thrill-a-minute story you'll never forget. A former U.S. military intelligence officer is haunted by intense dreams about a beautiful woman pleading for his help after a terrible battle in outer space. But the dreams turn out to be true and thrust him into a telepathic love affair with a woman whose faraway planet is intent on destroying the Earth. And now the gripping tale continues in The Coming of the Protectors. It's the second book of the Rockoids trilogy, a galaxy-spanning adventure that pits our hapless heroes against powerful, fanatical enemies that threaten the lives of freedom-loving beings everywhere. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors, classic science fiction at its best, available now. For more details, visit Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids.com.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pau D'Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus doesn't grow on. So it naturally has antifungal, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-infection, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. But maybe more importantly, Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pau D'Arco Super Tea builds corpuscles in the blood which carry oxygen to our organs and cells. Our organs and cells need oxygen to regenerate themselves. The immune system needs oxygen to develop, and cancer happens to die in oxygen. The tea is great for healthy people, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pau D'Arco Super Tea is only $34.95 plus shipping. Order now at shopsupertea.com or call 818-984-6100. That's shopsupertea.com or call 818-984-6100. Shopsupertea.com.